Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we're diving into the world of noble dining in the Middle Ages. Food as a status symbol. That sounds quite modern, doesn't it?
But that's exactly what it was back then. If you've been seated at the table of a duke or king in medieval times, it wasn't just about filling your stomach. It was about power, prestige, and demonstrating wealth.
The whole display was already evident in the tableware. While common folk ate from wooden or ceramic bowls, wealthy households had pewter, and at princely courts, even silver. And then there were those, what were they called again?
Trenchers. That's interesting because many people think they were always thick slices of bread used as plates. But how do I explain this best? Picture more of a flat platter, often made of wood or pewter. They were about the size of a breakfast plate, a bit smaller than our dinner plates today, but large enough for a meal.
Bread slices as a base did exist as well, but that was the older version. And the bread was used in different ways afterwards, sometimes eaten by the diners themselves, sometimes given as alms to the poor.
That's right, and here's the fascinating part. The bread was
collected as alms, at least at court. They gave it to the poor. For nobles to eat it themselves would have been unseemly. And that was precisely the point, this ostentatious generosity. But for common people, it was perfectly normal.
You're well informed. This also shows the whole hierarchy. The sauces and juices soaked into the bread, and at great courts, this was often given to the needy. Practical and symbolic at the same time.
Though, I wonder, how did they eat then? Without the bread as a utensil?
Mainly with knife and spoon. Forks only came into fashion much later. The food was brought on large serving platters and people helped themselves. Usually two people shared one platter.
And the best pieces naturally went to the highest ranking guests. This was strictly regulated. The duke got the filet. The minor knight got the offal.
By the way, this is where the English expression eating humble pie comes from, meaning to admit you were wrong. It probably derives from umbles pie, umbles being deer offal. The similarity in sound to humble did the rest. Pies made from these were for the
less important guests.
Yes, exactly how it was. But back to the luxury items on the table. Besides the fine tableware, spices also played a huge role.
And that brings us to saffron. That was the prestige spice par excellence.
Absolutely. Just imagine. For 1 kilogram of saffron, you need the stigmas from about 50,000 to 70,000 flowers. That's over 150,000 individual threads, all harvested by hand, within a tiny time window.
That explains the price. Back then, it was usually significantly more expensive than pepper, often 3 times as much. And pepper alone was already worth a fortune.
Saffron came mainly via Mediterranean trade routes from the Orient, and later from Spain and Italy as well. And do you know what it was primarily used for?
For colouring. That intense golden yellow colour in the food was a statement. If your food glowed golden, everyone knew, here sits someone with money.
Exactly. The famous saffron egg tarts, for example, that wasn't just delicious, it was visible luxury on the plate. A sweet contrast to the savoury game.
And to drink? What was special there?
Hippocras. That was the star among noble beverages. sweetened, spiced wine, red or white, strained through filter cloth, served as a digestif at the very end of the meal and therefore often cold, not like our mulled wine.
With cinnamon, ginger, sometimes saffron too, served alongside wafers, spiced biscuits or confections, as a sweet conclusion to the noble feast.
And that's exactly the point. Even seemingly simple things were carefully considered at court. Every detail, from the pewter plate to the spiced wine, sent a message.
Status, power, refinement. Food as communication, long before Instagram was invented.
Medieval food staging, so to speak. But you know what fascinates me most about all this? The table manners themselves were just as carefully thought out as the food.
Now it gets really exciting. The meat on the noble table. Because when we talk about status, venison was the prestige item par excellence.
Venison especially. The stag was considered the king of the forest, and red deer fell under the so-called forest ban, usually reserved for the territorial lord, though there were regional differences.
And this was strictly regulated. There was the so-called high hunt and the low hunt. Red deer and wild boar counted as high game, reserved for the territorial lord in many places. This wasn't unified imperial law, but regulated territorially. Wild boar, by the way, was particularly esteemed because of its dangerousness.
While roe deer and hare counted as low game. These could sometimes be hunted by the lower nobility or even free peasants. But stag? Absolutely forbidden to common folk.
And anyone who poached anyway risked
serious consequences. In the early Middle Ages, mainly fines and penalties. But the later it got, the harsher the punishments became. In the late Middle Ages, you faced confiscation of property, mutilation, blinding even appears in folk traditions, though that was actually more of a punishment for high treason. It's hard to verify for poaching specifically.
This puts into perspective the myth that every poacher was automatically hanged. The death penalty only became systematic in the early modern period. But clearly, the punishments were harsh enough.
This also shows how important this privilege was. To serve venison meant, I have my own lands, I have the right to hunt, I am part of the elite.
And then the preparation itself. Venison was roasted, on a spit, for example, or braised, often with spices and savory sauces. Rich, flavorful. A true feast.
But what fascinates me even more is the matter of poultry.
That's actually counterintuitive. Slaughtering a laying hen was less of a luxury for peasant households than an economic sacrifice. You're giving up future eggs, after all. For feast tables, capons or young chickens were more prestigious. You're essentially sacrificing future income for a single celebration.
That's a way of thinking that hardly anyone has today. We buy chicken at the supermarket and don't think about the eggs that bird could have laid.
But for medieval peasants, this was existential. The eggs were food, barter value, income. To slaughter a hen was almost, well, waste doesn't quite capture it. More of a deliberate demonstration. I can afford it.
And this display of one's status was omnipresent. Not just in the choice of dishes, but also very concretely in how they were distributed at the table.
This was a clear, visible sign of appreciation, or indeed of a guest's subordinate position.
This shows how deeply social structure was embedded in even the smallest detail of the culinary experience.
Absolutely. Right down to every detail.
Every meal was thus also a constant staging of one's position within society.
That's so characteristic of medieval society. Even at meals, the social order was constantly made visible.
Every bite sent a message, and the guests knew this, of course. Who got which piece was no accident, but a political statement.
This also explains why these banquets were so important. It was never just about filling your stomach. Alliances were forged, hierarchies confirmed, power demonstrated. All through the meat on the plate.
And venison was the ultimate symbol. Not just delicious, but proof of access to rare resources, of hunting privileges, of land and power. Now we come to an aspect that's often underestimated. Table manners themselves. These weren't trivial matters, but a complex social code.
And it started even before the actual meal. Before anything was served, there was the ritual hand washing.
And this was truly a performance. Servants brought special vessels, called aquamaniles. These were often jugs made of bronze or brass, frequently shaped like animals. Lions, horses, mythical creatures.
Plus a shallow basin to catch the water and a fine linen cloth. And here's the interesting part. Hands weren't washed in the basin.
The water was poured over the hands. The basin only served to catch it. This was important for the concept of cleanliness. Flowing water was considered more purifying.
And the perfumed water?
That was more of a luxury variant, especially in the late, from the 14th, 15th century onwards. Rosemary, lavender, rose water. But for the normal case, imagine plain water.
What I find fascinating, the order of hand washing strictly followed the ranking. The highest ranking person first, then descending. Everyone immediately knew where they stood in the hierarchy.
And mistakes in timing or sequence could be taken as a real insult. This wasn't a hygiene quirk, it was political communication.
Oh, that explains so much. Hygiene as a social code, not as a health measure in the modern sense.
And it continued at the table. People ate with their right hand. The left was kept back at the table.
This has a practical origin. The left hand was traditionally responsible for, let's say, other bodily needs. But at the table, this became a fixed rule.
As for cutlery itself, the selection was limited. There was really only the knife and...
the spoon, right. And as we've already heard, forks only came along much later.
Though much later is relative. At the Byzantine court, there were eating forks as early as the 10th, 11th century. The famous Theodora Ducaina shocked Venice with them in the 1070s. But in Central and Northern Europe, that took centuries.
Why, actually? Sounds practical enough.
Several reasons. First, the combination of knife, spoon and fingers worked perfectly well for the foods of the time. Stews, porridges, pieces of meat. A fork simply wasn't necessary.
And second, the early forks, two-pronged, pointed, straight, were designed more for serving, not really practical as eating utensils.
In France, the king owned only a handful of forks in the mid-14th century. You could count them on one hand. These were absolute luxury objects, not everyday items.
Catherine de' Medici then popularized Italian table manners at the French court in the mid-16th century, including the fork, which already existed there. But even then, it took until...
the 17th, 18th century before it really caught on. The practical fork with four curved tines, as we know it, emerged in the 18th century. as a mass product only really in the 19th century with industrialization.
This also puts into perspective the myth that the church banned the fork as the devil's tool.
That's actually not documented. There was moral criticism of luxury and affectation, certainly. Luther and Erasmus mocked fashionable pretentiousness. But an actual ban? No.
The reasons were much more mundane. Habit, cost, practicality. Why something new when the old works?
And those who knew the rules, when to wash hands, which hand to use, how to handle knife and spoon, they belonged. Those who didn't immediately revealed themselves as outsiders.
Table manners as a badge of the elite. Almost like a secret handshake, just with more grease stains. Now it gets really exciting for book lovers. Cookbooks in the Middle Ages. These were by no means everyday objects.
Absolutely not. To own a cookbook was a genuine status symbol. They stood in the libraries of nobles alongside theological works and chronicles.
And the most famous example is The Form of Curry, the oldest surviving cookbook in the English language. Created around 1390, so late 14th century, and written by the cooks at the court of Richard II.
The name is misleading to modern ears, by the way. Curry has nothing to do with curry.
That's Middle English for cooking. So the meaning is essentially the method of cooking, or on the art of cookery.
And what kind of recipes were in there?
Around 200 of them, and the standard was impressive. Elaborate meat dishes with almond milk sauces, fish recipes for Lent, a famous dish called blancmange, which was, how do I best describe this? A kind of white pudding made from almonds, rice, and shredded chicken.
That sounds remarkably sophisticated.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
It was. Plus recipes for Hippocras, the spiced wine with cinnamon, ginger, cloves, nutmeg, the full range of expensive imported spices. This was definitely not peasant fare.
To own such books meant, I have access to this knowledge. I can afford cooks who prepare such things. I belong to the cultured elite.
And when it comes to someone who applied this knowledge, or rather, took it to excess, I immediately think of
Henry VIII, early modern period, but the perfect example.
Yes, him.
He's the textbook example of royal gluttony. When we talked about meat as a status symbol, with Henry, that became a life philosophy.
What did he eat then?
Enormous quantities of meat, every day. Game, poultry, beef, plus fine white bread, sweet pastries, confections loaded with sugar, and practically no vegetables.
From a nutritional standpoint, that's catastrophic.
And the tragic thing is, he was an athlete as a young man. An estimated 6'1" or taller, athletic, loved tournaments and hunting. Contemporary accounts rave about his physical presence.
But then came the decline.
Several serious riding accidents, including a bad jousting accident in 1536. After that, he could barely move. But his eating habits, they stayed the same.
And this is documented in his armor, isn't it?
That's the fascinating and at the same time disturbing part. His early armor shows a well-trained man. But the later pieces, housed in the Tower of London, they have a waist circumference of about 53 to 55 inches.
Just imagine that. For someone of an estimated height of about 6'1".
Estimates suggest a body weight of 290 to 330 pounds. The often cited 400 pounds is probably exaggerated, but even 310 pounds is extreme for that era.
And the health consequences were massive. Chronic leg ulcers that wouldn't heal, probably heart problems, joint damage, possibly diabetes, even if they didn't call it that back then.
And what's interesting from a social perspective, nobody in his circle ever contradicted him. No advisor, no friend ever questioned his eating habits.
Because you don't contradict a king?
Because you didn't contradict Henry VIII. This wasn't just any king. This was a man who had wives executed and took on the Pope. Who was going to tell him to eat less?
This also shows the downside of absolute power. Nobody could protect him from himself. His privileges, the unlimited meat, the sweet foods, the lack of physical exertion, literally killed him.
The irony is, the same dining culture that was meant to demonstrate power and status became his downfall. The meat that symbolized nobility destroyed him.
A cautionary tale, hidden among all the splendor of the medieval feast.
So, what remains at the end of our journey through medieval dining culture? I find the contrast to today fascinating and sobering at the same time.
The fascinating thing is, in the Middle Ages, nutritional philosophy was based on the theory of humours. Four bodily fluids that had to be in balance: blood, phlegm, yellow and black bile.
From today's perspective, outdated of course, but it was a system. People thought about why certain foods were good or bad for them.
Today we have proteins, carbohydrates, micronutrients, scientifically grounded. We can calculate exactly what the body needs. And yet...
And yet I sometimes feel that with all the...
efficiency, we've lost the enjoyment?
Exactly that. Modern nutrition is optimized. Quick, practical, balanced. But time-consuming preparation, shared dining as a social ritual, that's taking a backseat.
Medieval cooking was time-intensive, no question. Hours at the open fire, everything by hand. But the result was quality-focused. Fresh ingredients, seasonal availability, craftsmanship.
And if I'm honest, wholemeal bread with a good crust, a creamy pea puree with a piece of salmon fried in butter, that's timelessly delicious.
These are dishes that worked in the Middle Ages and still work today. Simple ingredients, carefully prepared.
What we can perhaps learn from medieval food culture, eating was more than just sustenance. It was communication, community, even politics.
Yes, that dimension is often missing today. We eat on the side, in front of screens, between appointments.
While in the Middle Ages, the table was a place where alliances were forged, hierarchies confirmed, and relationships cultivated.
Perhaps we shouldn't go back to the theory of humours, but the idea that a shared meal is more than just calories, that's something we could rediscover.
And with that, we've come to the end of today's episode. Medieval dining culture, from pewter plates to venison to Henry VIII.
A topic that shows history is often much more accessible than we think. Food connects us across centuries.
If you enjoyed this topic and want to learn more about historical everyday culture, do check out battlemerchant.com. On the blog, you'll find many more fascinating topics about history and historical living.
From equipment to knowledge, there's plenty to discover.
Thanks for listening.
Until next time.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.